Let me ask about some of the things you've said about Vladimir Putin. You said, I will tell you, in terms of leadership, he's getting an A. Our president is not doing so well. And when referring to a comment that Putin made about you, I think he called you a brilliant leader, you said, it's always a great honor to be so nicely complimented by a man so highly respected within his country and beyond.
Well, he does have an 82% approval rating, according to the different pollsters, who, by the way, some of them are based right here. Look,
he's also a guy who annexed Crimea, invaded Ukraine, supports Assad in Syria, supports Iran, is trying to undermine our influence in key regions of the world, and according to our intelligence community, probably is the main suspect for the hacking of the DNC computers.
Well, nobody knows that for a fact, but do you want me to start naming some of the things that President Obama does?
But do you want to be complimented by that former KGB officer?
Well, I think when he calls me brilliant, I'll take the compliment, okay?
It's really strange to have then-candidate Trump and now President Trump to hear those words leaving his mouth about how great this other world leader is and how awful America is. So often I hear about how America, and I hear this from conservatives, right? They're generally completely unwilling to criticize America. They are totally willing to criticize Democrats, but they are unwilling to criticize America, which has always been sort of a strange thing for me. I remember when Colin Kaepernick decided that he wasn't going to sit up or stand up for the pledge anymore. And, oh my God, how dare he, right? Which is essentially Colin Kaepernick saying, you know what, America's got some problems. And then this guy hits the world stage, and he's not just saying that America's got problems. He's saying America is awful, right? It's not great right now. He wants to make it great because it's not great right now. So how is that whole thing with making America greater, Esther-er, going? At this point, sad. So sad. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on the Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 198. I do enjoy the hour that we spend together every week. Let's get this ball rolling.
You made some comments about the American Republican presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. You called him brilliant, outstanding, talented. These comments were reported around the world. I was wondering what in him led you to that judgment, and do you still hold that judgment?
You personally are very famous in our country. You are not only famous as a journalist in one of the biggest TV stations, but as an intellectual. Why do you always change the meaning of what I said? Because at the moment, you speak as a journalist, not as an analyst. Why are you juggling with what I said? I only said that he was a bright person. Isn't he bright? He is. I did not say anything else about him.
So that was Vladimir Putin being asked by the media about why he called Donald Trump bright. So at that point, Putin says, now, wait a minute. Is he not bright? Later on, Putin tried to clarify those comments by saying, oh, hold on. The way we use their word, meaning bright, as in brilliant, for them, it means bright, like illuminated. You know, like, I guess it would be more bombastic and not actually smart. Is he not bombastic and loud and bright like a light is bright? Lost in translation a little bit there. But obviously, it's strange to hear that the kind of love that Putin has for this guy. And why is Putin all of a sudden? I've been hearing about this guy for a long time. And I have to admit, prior to assembling this show, my knowledge about Russia and Putin and all the rest, it wasn't really all that extensive. I do spend a fair amount of time reading Professor Stephen F. Cohen's articles about Russia, and he's written books about Russia. He writes for The Nation magazine, and I've learned quite a bit about Russia from him. He's fairly brilliant on this subject. But I didn't really go too much beyond his writings in the past because I didn't really feel like I needed to. Now, all of a sudden, Russia seems to be the big deal. When assembling this show, I wanted to get into Russia. I wanted to talk about their relationship with the election, you know, the way it's being played right now in the media, the way it's being played right now by the Democrats. And then I wanted to get into how I think that it's just a distraction and how we need to pay attention to these other things that the Trump administration is doing. So I write all of this stuff down on a page. And I'm looking at the phrase that I've written on my page, Russia is a distraction. Russia is a distraction. I'm just staring at the word distraction. And I really, really think about it. And I say, I'm questioning myself. I go, is it? Is it a distraction? Or is there something real here? My initial premise with this show was to get into more of the things that the Trump administration has been doing that are going to be detrimental for all of us, and to say, stay the hell away from this Russian thing. Because I feel like the Democrats are staking their entire existence on the Russia thing right now, which is to say, they're doing an okay job of challenging the Trump administration right now. I would say Indivisible and the ACLU and state's attorneys generals from the blue states, they're doing a better job of challenging the Trump administration than, say, the Democratic Party is. Because some of the members of the Democratic Party are going along with the Trump administration. Now, I understand it's John Tester from Montana, and it's Joe Manchin from West Virginia, and we kind of expect that from those guys. But wait a minute. If you're not a Democrat, if you're not a progressive, then you probably don't deserve that title. And if you're going along with what the Trump administration is doing, then you don't deserve to be a member of the Democratic Party. And I want to say to the Democratic Party, don't stake the entire next election on just dirtying this guy up with this whole Russia story. But it's impossible to ignore all of the Russian stuff that came out during the election, like when Trump himself decided to go on RT. RT is Russia Today. And by the way, there's an RT in Russia. That's their state-run news agency. There's an RT America, which shares the name, but not the same goal. And Kellyanne Conway was asked, I'm sorry, if he doesn't have a relationship with Russia, why the hell is he going on RT?
Why would Donald Trump do an interview with Russian TV that is sponsored by the Kremlin?
He actually did an interview with Larry King, a personal friend of his, a friend of, I'm sure, everyone around the table. And he said he was doing it for his podcast, didn't know it would be on Russian TV. But what he said there was,
how does something like that happen, that the campaign doesn't know that his words are going to be played on Kremlin state TV? Larry King was doing the interview for Kremlin State TV.
He goes on Russia TV with Larry King, and he talks again about the U.S. in an unflattering way to a Russian audience. What is the virtue of criticizing the United States to a Russian audience?
Well, first of all, as you know, a former CNN superstar Larry King has a podcast, and Mr. Trump went on his podcast. Nobody said it was going to be on Russian TV.
Okay, so there's their excuse. They say, well, it's Larry King. And yeah, by the way, Larry King does work for RT. And then during the election, we just kept hearing over and over and over again, hack, hack, hack.
I'm Ed Donahue.
Every American should be alarmed by Russia's attacks on our nation.
Senate Armed Services Committee Chair John McCain asked Director of National Intelligence James Clapper today if Russian interference during the presidential election is an act of war.
Whether or not that constitutes an act of war, I think, is a very heavy policy call that I don't believe the intelligence community should make. But it's certainly would carry, in my view, great gravity.
Clapper testified there was no doubt Russia interfered. He also pushed back at recent criticism by President-elect Donald Trump of intelligence agencies over the contention Russia interfered to help him win in November.
An act of war. Russia has great power, but Russia would like to have greater power. This wasn't the only story about hacking, by the way. It just seemed to cascade the more time went on.
The Senate Intelligence Committee will investigate the CIA's assessment that Russia interfered in the November election on behalf of Donald Trump. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tells reporters,
any foreign breach of our cybersecurity measures is disturbing, and I strongly condemn any such efforts.
Trump transition advisor Kellyanne Conway tells NBC's Today show the president-elect doesn't oppose President Obama's calls for an inquiry, as long as it doesn't focus on a single culprit.
We don't have credible and complete evidence that there's a direct nexus between anything that Russia did and Hillary Clinton's loss in the election.
Whenever major media spends a lot of time on something, I think to myself, you know what? There's probably not anything to that story because they're willing to spend a lot of time on... Hold on. Breaking news.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell fully supports a Senate Intelligence Committee investigation into the CIA conclusion that Russia was behind the campaign hacking and it may have been trying to help Donald Trump.
The Russians are not our friends.
McConnell says the CIA and other intelligence groups are apolitical.
I have the highest confidence in the intelligence community and especially the central intelligence agencies. The CIA is filled with selfless patriots, many of whom anonymously risk their lives for the American people.
I think you get the point. And then what McConnell pointed out right there, the Russians are not our friends. So Jamie Herrera-Butler, I mentioned this, she's my representative. She decided to hold a telephone town hall in place of an in-person town hall because she is chicken S. And one of the first things she said in that phone call, because one of the first questions she got was about Russia. And she said, Russia is not our friend. So here's what you need to know about Russia. Here's how concerned you should be about Russia or not be concerned about Russia. And here's where I think that we should go from here. So Vladimir Putin became the head of Russia. He became President Putin in March of 2000. In December 1999, Boris Yeltsin resigned. And he essentially didn't put in place, but he said that he favored Putin becoming president. So 17 years later, Putin is still president. How is he still president? This was perplexing to me. I asked myself, are there no term limits in Russia? Does he really have like an 80, 90% approval rating like Donald Trump says he does? So here's what he does to thwart democracy. And as you heard in that clip earlier, Putin also does not like the media. And he regularly chastises them. And worse, he regularly has members of the media murdered. Although we cannot directly connect the murders with him, the people that end up murdered that are journalists are always critics of his. So there's a line there, although it's not super duper clear. So here's how it goes. Putin wins the presidency in 2000. He then runs and wins again in 2004 to be president. In 2004, he won by a landslide. And so he says, okay, that's it. I'm essentially president for life. Then 2008 comes and he's not able to run for president again. So Dmitry Medvedev runs and wins the presidency and then keeps Putin on as prime minister. But in effect, Putin is still president. Then Vladimir Putin in 4 years runs again to be president. And so, and for whatever reason, they're having an election next year in 2018. So he plans on just switching back and forth, right? So Dmitry Medvedev shares the presidency with him. So now Dmitry Medvedev is the prime minister. And then, you know, if Putin, you know, doesn't, you know, Putin wants to be president for life, they'll just keep switching roles back and forth. And what about Putin's critics? So this from Reuters, the Washington, D.C. Medical Examiner's Office has just confirmed that former Russian press minister Mikhail Lezin died of blunt force trauma to the head. Lezin, who founded the English language television network RT, was found dead in a Washington, D.C. hotel room in November 2015. This is from March of last year. The Daily Beast reports that before his death, Lezin was considering making a deal with the FBI to protect himself from corruption charges. For years, Lezin had been at the heart of a political life in Russia that would have known a lot about the inner workings of the rich and powerful. It's the other thing you got to know about Putin. Putin is a billionaire. Easily one of the wealthiest people in the world, if not the wealthiest. But being president of Russia only pays hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, much like the presidency here in America. I think our president makes about $350,000 a year. So how in the hell is he a billionaire? He wasn't a billionaire prior to getting into office, but he's a billionaire now. And a lot of the press has started figuring this out, and they've paid a very, very heavy price for it. Alexander Litvinenko was a former KGB agent who died 3 weeks after drinking a cup of tea at a London hotel that had been laced with polonium-210. A British inquiry found that Litvinenko was poisoned by FSB agents who were acting on orders that were probably approved by President Putin. Litvinenko was very critical of Putin, accusing him of, among other things, blowing up an apartment block and ordering the murder of journalist Anna Politkovskaya. I'm terrible with these names. Politkovskaya. I worked on these names. My Russia is terrible. Please forgive me. So we're just going to call her Anna. Anna was a Russian journalist who also critical of Putin. In her book, Putin's Russia, she accused Putin of turning his country into a police state. She was murdered by contract killers who shot her at point-blank range in the lift outside her flat. Five men were convicted of her murder, but the judge found that it was a contract killing for $150,000 by an unknown person. And it goes on. Natalia, Boris Nemtsov, Boris Bezrovsky, Sergei Yushchenkov, Paul Klebanikov. All of these people died under mysterious circumstances, all of them journalists, and some of them were murdered right in front of the Kremlin. And obviously the common thread is that they were all critics of Putin. So here's where I become increasingly concerned. What I see happening right now with our media is a slow build. And it's been going on for a number of years. There are a bunch of conservative groups that have long tried to maintain that American media is obviously run by a bunch of liberals, right? All these people have gone to college. All these people have degrees. They all have brains in their head. They must be liberals. And you'll see these bumper stickers. I'm sure they're in your town because they're certainly in my town. And I live in a pretty progressive town. But it'll say, I don't trust the liberal media. If you turn on Fox or right-wing radio, you heard all the, I don't trust liberal media. Liberal media, liberal media. There is no liberal media. Well, I suppose I'm the liberal media, but I'm clearly a liberal. I will tell you that. Hi, my name is Melvin. I have a show called The Fire You Can't Put Out, and I am a progressive, and I do not try to hide that. I don't lie in order to make my case, but I'm also unabashedly progressive. I believe in the things that Jesus believed in. I myself do not believe in Jesus, but I believe in the teachings of Jesus. So if you want to know where I'm at on a particular issue, you could probably say, what would Jesus do? I would like to feed the hungry. I would like to take care of the sick. I would like to house the homeless. I want people to have health care. I would like women to hold power equal to that of men. I don't believe in violence. I'm a lot like Jesus, which means I'm not a conservative. Those are the folks who say that they're following Jesus. Don't get confused. Stick with me. But if you're turning on CNN or MSNBC or any of those, you're not watching progressive media. You're not watching the liberal media. But what you are watching is media that is sometimes critical of conservatives. Now, when they're critical of liberals, and by the way, some of these outlets like CNN and MSNBC will go out of their way trying to be critical of progressives because they don't want to be seen as liberal. And when they do that, obviously they're not given credit for that. But as soon as they start talking about a conservative, oh, well, that's what you get for watching the Clinton News Network. That's what they call CNN. So here's what I'm concerned about with the Trump presidency. There's an article in the Washington Post by Michael McFaul, and he points out how Putin rose to power, how he maintains power, his relationship with the media and with his own country, and the way Donald Trump is conducting himself. Quoting here, like Trump, Putin had never run for elected office until he won Russia's presidential election in March 2000. Few at the time in Russia or in the world fully understood Putin's political agenda, given his political inexperience, weak support among elites, and tenuous electoral mandate. Most observers assumed initially that he could not change the basic nature of Russia's political system, considered by most analysts at the time as a weak but a functioning democracy. That early assessment turned out to be incorrect. Obviously, 17 years later, he's still in power. When first elected president, Putin promised to make Russia great again. Why am I hearing echoes? To do so, he pledged to end the economic collapse, political chaos, and lawlessness. The carnage, if you will, he pointed out, of the 1990s. He ran as the law and order candidate. There's that echo again. Putin responded by promising a harsh crackdown on terrorism and restoring sovereignty over Russia's borders. He then invaded Chechnya and used brutal methods to end hostage standoffs with terrorists that resulted in the deaths of hundreds of civilians. Trump has already gotten a ton of civilians killed in his not very thought out Yemen raid. We'll get to that in a little bit. In Moscow and other large Russian cities, security forces rounded up and deported Chechens and other Muslim minority immigrants from Central Asia and Caucasians who allegedly looked like Chechen terrorists. Putin also moved quickly against another declared enemy of the state, the independent press. He chased Vladimir Gazunsky, the owner of Russia's most important private television company, out of the country and eventually seized control of the television network. Putin did the same to Boris Berezovsky, taking control of his television company as well. Further crackdowns on other pockets of independent media came later. Putin accomplished these aims and most of the others that followed by means of presidential decree, the Russian equivalent of an executive order in the United States. Today, of course, we see clearly how Putin's first modest anti-democratic steps ultimately led to autocracy. When Putin faced challenges to his power or constraints on his personal rule, he chose to increase repression, not to moderate. He arrested business leaders who dared to try funding opposition parties, including, most dramatically, the richest man in Russia at the time, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Khodorkovsky. I'm dying with these Russian names, I'm sorry. He used the powers of the state to limit real competition in national elections. He ended the direct election of governors. And when tens of thousands of Russians took to the streets to protest against his regime in December of 2011, Putin labeled them as traitors and puppets of the United States, and then used a variety of means, disinformation, blackmail, and arrests based on bogus charges to weaken and eliminate his opponents. One of the leaders of these protests, Boris Nemtsov, was later assassinated. Some remain in jail or under house arrest, while many others now live in exile. Just last week, liberal opposition leader Vladimir Kara-Murza was apparently poisoned for the second time in 2 years. And by the way, that guy is still recovering. And with the elections happening in Russia next year, the man who was gaining some traction and looked like he was going to run against Putin and likely successfully run against Putin to be the president of Russia, was recently convicted on what I'm going to refer to as trumped up charges. He was accused of fraud with some timber futures or some crap that really doesn't make any sense. It's this really obscure law that the Russian government had to go find a specific judge that was going to give them the ruling that they wanted so that they could convict this guy and then ultimately disqualify him from running against Putin next year. And then this brings us clearly to what was a hack in our election.
She's saying Russia, 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 but I don't, maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?
Let's say that Russia wanted the Trump outcome, but let's also say that they really weren't doing anything in order to make it happen. Russia is a power, just like us. Their power is not as great as ours is, but they do very much have a great deal of power. Here's what we know about Putin's relationship with the Clintons. Back during the 90s, Putin is under the impression that President Bill Clinton at that time was trying to get some of the countries that border Russia, Georgia, Ukraine, Belarus. It was his belief that Bill Clinton was trying to get these countries to join NATO. He doesn't want any of these countries that are connected to his country to join NATO. And he himself does not want to join NATO. And then, of course, the 2012 elections seemed to be flawed. They seemed to be tilted very heavily for Putin. And Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, decided to speak out against the 2012 elections, saying that those elections were clearly not fair. Right? They were clearly tilted for Putin, that they were not free and fair elections. And so Putin hates the Clintons. Now, some of us here in America, we're not big fans of the Clintons either. But right away, and we knew that Hillary Clinton was going to run for president, because it was really all the media talked about. Ever since her defeat in 2008, the media was constantly pushing the meme that she's going to run again. And I think that Putin was licking his lips, hoping that she would. These hacks, maybe they did happen, and maybe they did not happen. But if they didn't happen, we need to clear the air right now. We need an investigation to prove that these things did not happen. Then, of course, if these things did happen, we need to know that as well. There's a great deal of resistance coming out of the Trump administration to investigate this. It's no secret how the Russians feel about the American government. Now, let me say this. The Russian people, I don't think that the Russian people are the enemy of America. I believe Putin and Putin's government very much are. They clearly don't care a lot for their people. They clearly don't care about democracy, from the slanted elections in their country to helping slant the election in our country. Putin and his government, they are not good people. They are clearly colluding and they are clearly fleecing their country. The Russian people, and by the way, I don't believe that any people are bad. I don't believe any race of people are bad or inherently bad. I don't believe that any religion is inherently bad. So let me say, when I say Russians, I don't have a problem with Russian people. I have encountered, not a lot, but a few Russian people here in America. And my view of anybody that I meet, most of my interactions with anybody have always been positive. But whenever they've been negative, for me, it was never, well, that's because that guy's a Russian, or because that guy's this, or because that guy's that. It's always, if I'm dealing with a crap attitude, things of that nature, those kinds of people I don't like. Somebody who's caustic, so on and so forth. To point out one of the things wrong with the Putin government, they just legalized domestic abuse. I'm not kidding about this. Domestic violence is now legal in Putin's Russia. You may also know that homosexuality is illegal, okay? And it's punishable by jail and or prison time. And of course, when asked about this law, Putin said, it's cool because we don't have any gay people here in Russia. There are clearly gay people in Russia. And this is just one more thing where for folks to say, hey, you know what? At least Trump's going to be good on LGBT issues. No, because he's Putin's puppet. And Putin is clearly horribly, horribly anti-gay. So this bill to legalize domestic violence sounds like the kind of bill that might be brought forward by a guy, perhaps a guy who likes beating on his wife and doesn't want to be convicted of it anymore. Say a guy like, oh, I don't know, Steve Bannon, who we know has a history with this. But no, this bill was sponsored by a female legislator in Russia. It was voted on, it was passed, and it was signed by President Putin. And domestic violence is now legal in Russia. And I don't think that this is a reflection on the Russian people. I believe that they did not take the threat or the idea of Putin's Russia very seriously. Looking back, we can tell both the press and the people didn't think much of it. But he has gained himself so much power by this point that it's going to be incredibly hard to unseat him, because he either kills, has arrested, or disqualifies anybody who looks like they might be able to mount a credible charge against his version of Russia.
So I think you can probably understand, Mr. Tillerson, why some of us are very concerned about the president-elect's statements praising Vladimir Putin's leadership, his intelligence, including after being reminded of his ruthless persecution of political enemies, and after receiving compelling information that Russia has interfered with our elections. So do you think now is the right time to lift sanctions against Russia?
I think it's important that we keep the status quo until we are able to develop what our approach is going to be.
That's Rex Tillerson, the former head of ExxonMobil. So Rex Tillerson is now the Secretary of State, right? He's head of the State Department. How did he become the head of the State Department? You may or may not know this, but Rex Tillerson, who was nominated by President Trump, had never ever met Trump in his entire life until last year. Rex Tillerson has a deep, deep, deep relationship with the Russian government. He spent quite a bit of time one-on-one with Putin and with Putin's government. He was given a couple of years ago the Order of Friendship by Putin, which is the highest civilian honor that you can get in Russia. And up until last year, had never said two words to Donald Trump. And this year, he's nominated to be Secretary of State and is confirmed and is now Secretary of State. He's never held a government position in his whole life. It appears that this is something that Putin wanted. And since he has become Secretary of State, he's began gutting the State Department. The same State Department, by the way, that Hillary Clinton used to run. The same State Department that has been helping to carry out sanctions against Russia. See, it's hard to say if what is being carried out right now in the State Department and in some of these other agencies, if this is directly what Putin wants. But it's a fairly safe assumption to say that, yeah, these are the things that Putin wants. I think Putin's Russia, Putin wants to be the superpower that America is, and he's not going to be that. There are a lot of ways where Putin's Russia does not measure up to America, where his government does not measure up to our government. But with gutting the State Department right now, there are people in the State Department. The most recent one to be ousted had been there for 40 years. The guy was in his 60s, was showing no signs of leaving. But then Tillerson comes in and the whole place just gets cleaned out. All of the institutional knowledge that is inside our State Department is now gone. And it's a fairly safe assumption to say that this is the outcome that Putin wanted. So one could also assert that it's not just the State Department that's being gutted. You know, Pruitt is gutting the EPA. And of course, DeVos is gutting the Department of Education. So all of these people that have been put in charge of all of these things, they're gutting all of these agencies. It's not just the State Department. But it seems to me that the State Department is the one that is the most important for Putin. I think Putin does want a better relationship with America. And perhaps he thought that by putting a friendly Secretary of State in that he would get that. And so much I've been hearing from the media lately, oh man, I bet you they're regretting this whole Trump thing now because now they're not going to have a good relationship with America, you know, because everyone is suspicious of the relationship that Trump has with Russia. And, you know, they want that good relationship now. They're not going to get it with us. And so I hear this a lot on the media. Perhaps Putin now has buyer's remorse for helping Donald Trump. I don't think so. Maybe they do want that better relationship with us. But I think more than anything, they would like to be bigger than us. They would like to be better than us, and they would like to be more powerful than us. And then, of course, when it comes to folks like Putin and Trump, enough money is never enough money. And there's always an opportunity for further fleecing. Yeah, it's going to be tough to have a good relationship with Russia after this, but maybe that's not what they're looking for. Maybe what they're looking for is to gut the American government. Who knows what they want to do with us afterwards? Also, this might all just be speculation. speculation on Melvin's part. See, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I put this whole thing together. And I was going to say, Putin, Russia election, distraction. Let's get to these other things. But the more and more I read about this stuff, the more and more I looked into it, the more and more I listened, you know, to audio clips and Annie and all the rest, I said, holy hell, there might really be something here. But let me stress this point. We don't have solid evidence. We don't have solid evidence of hacking or any of the rest. We know that Putin and Trump, you know, love each other, you know, and the kissy face and all this. We know this stuff, but we don't have, I know, I'm being facetious. We don't have good, solid evidence that this is what went down. So this is where we need an investigation. Because if it's true, we need to do something about this right away. But of course, if it is not true, we need to put this baby to bed. Because they too have nuclear weapons. We have nuclear weapons. And what you're looking at that point, with where we're at with Russia right now, okay, the fact that they're saying they had nothing to do with this. And, you know, in Trump's administration, there was nothing to do with it. But then, you know, our journalists in the Democratic Party, there's definitely something going on. What you have right now are two trains that are speeding towards each other. And they're not slowing down. Both of these trains are picking up speed at an alarming rate. And at some point, they're going to collide. They're going to crash into each other. And it's going to be a spectacular explosion. And so what we need to do is we need to stop that from happening, because it's not going to be pretty. Both of these trains have a lot of cars attached to the engine, and those cars are full of nuclear weapons. We need to stop that from happening. We need an honest-to-goodness investigation. So, Attorney General and white supremacist Jeff Sessions has said, since he lied under oath, he said that he will recuse himself from any investigation of the Russian connection, which drew a swift angry response from President Trump, which means that the case is stronger, that there is something going on and that something did happen, stronger than the fact that maybe something did not happen.
The Indiana House has approved a bill to allow those protected by an order of protection to carry handguns without a license. The measure passed Tuesday on a 71-26 vote and now heads to the Senate. The Shelbyville Republican, Sean Eberhardt, who drafted the bill, said it allowed domestic violence victims to protect themselves without waiting for approval of a handgun license. Democrats say the measure is a Trojan horse designed to erode reasonable firearms restrictions. They say stats show many gun owners are killed with their own weapons. The bill also includes a provision calling for a special committee to study the elimination of Indiana's handgun licensing requirement. Republican Rep. Jim Lucas says doing away with the state's licensure requirement is his ultimate goal.
So let's talk about what's been happening inside the administration outside of all of this Russian stuff. Obviously, gun laws are being loosened and loosened supremely. The Trump administration signed the law, very quietly signed the law that allows the mentally ill to get guns. And then, of course, this gun law in Indiana, which you just heard about there. And I love the excuses they come up with for. They say that women, domestic violence victims, should get to protect themselves and they shouldn't have to wait for police protection, right? That's what they say. Look, this gun law, this is just so the ladies can protect themselves. It's more likely that those women are going to be shot and killed by their lover than it is that they're going to be able to protect themselves with your dumb little gun law. The need, they say, we need more guns because there's so many guns out there, we need more guns, right? And then more people have guns and they say, oh my God, look at all the guns, we need more guns. And then there's more, oh my God. And it feeds itself.
There's just been this measure to lift a gun control restriction that will now allow people with severe mental illness to get their hands on guns. How does that make sense?
Well, I don't look at that this way. You know, I'm a strong proponent of our Second Amendment rights. You know, it's interesting. This was a rule that President Obama came out with in December. long after he was a lame duck president. If this is something he was so committed to, you would have thought sometime in the previous 8 years he might have come out with such a regulation.
Well, sure, but he just came out with it in December. I mean, forget the timing, but what about the substance of it? I mean, why allow, if there's one point of agreement, bipartisan point of agreement that everyone has said, from gun enthusiasts to gun control activists, it's keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill. This sounds like it would make it easier for them to get their hands on guns.
Well, I don't view that way at all. I'd look at this from the standpoint, this is going up against Social Security and people who get Social Security checks, people who make financial decisions, and is putting the Social Security Administration in a point where they would then be determining who is reported in ways in terms of our Second Amendment rights.
As I understand it, it involves 75,000 people with mental disorders so severe that they cannot work, and that they have someone else manage their Social Security benefits. How does it make sense to let them have guns? If someone has a mental illness so severe that they cannot work, should they be able to have a gun?
I often wonder if Republican politicians honestly believe these things, or if they're just being paid to believe these things. That was Representative John Barrasso, Republican, saying, hey, you know what? Guns are a right. You should get more guns are a right. And then he says, look, and then, of course, the other excuse for allowing mentally ill people to have access to guns is that if this was so important to President Obama, why did he wait until the last day to do it? Which is just obviously ridiculous. But this is the reasoning that's being put forward about why our mentally ill people need to have guns. So, and then, of course, the other law that was signed by the president is the anti-clean water law, which more officially is the law overturning the stream protection rule. And what this allows coal companies to do is to dump their waste into our waterways, because clearly Republicans don't drink water. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And then, of course, with Scott Pruitt, the EPA already does not have enough money to address all the things they need to address. They already do not have enough manpower to address all the things that they want to address. But President Trump has said that him and Scott Pruitt want to cut the EPA's budget dramatically, right? This is gutting all of these agencies. And they would like to take that money and they'd like to give it to our gigantic military to make our military even more gigantic. This is John O'Grady, the head of the Union of the EPA.
Morale is in the basement, possibly lower. We're already at a point where we don't have enough staff to do everything that Congress has tasked us with. And to reduce the staff by another 3,000 is going to make it impossible for U.S. EPA to protect human health and the environment. They're going to cut climate change activities. They're going to cut waters of the United States.
My larger concern for this president, since he's clearly at this point failing at so many things and is coming under such strict and overwhelming opposition from the American people, you know, who don't see him as legitimate, who see him as somebody who clearly did not win the election and see him as somebody who does not reflect what they believe in. Bush had this problem back in 2000, and out of it, we got 9/11 and eventually the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which made him even more powerful and helped him win the 2004 election. Donald Trump has already registered to run for president again in 2020. Odds makers have him right now, and I think they're underestimating him, not even being able to serve out his entire first term. Right. If you put money down right now and it turns out that it's true, I think it's like 1-1 or something. It's nothing. I mean, it's nothing that they're giving you for the odds of him even making it through his first year. But he seems to think he's going to make it through his first year, second year, third year, and even fourth year, and win again in 2020. What makes him so certain? I think what's happening in the halls of the White House right now is they're looking for more and more propaganda that they can use against the American people to galvanize more and more power for this president. So he gave his joint address to Congress. a couple of weeks ago. And that's what it's referred to as when you're the new president, because obviously it's not a State of the Union. You've only been president for about a month. But about this time of year, and it's usually in January, you speak to a joint session of Congress. That's a State of the Union. So when he had his speech to the joint session of Congress, I couldn't help but notice the American media just gushing after it was all over about how tonight Donald Trump became presidential. Well, what did he do that made him so damn presidential that didn't make him presidential when he talked about how he sexually assaulted women, just grabbed them by their Virginias, right? When he said things like, when I get home and dinner's not ready, I'm going to go through the roof. How was he not presidential back then, right? When he's calling people names, when he's tweeting at 10 in the morning after getting out of a high-level staff meeting about how this clothing retailer is just being so unfair to his daughter. How were those things not presidential? But the thing that he said at the State of the Union, all of a sudden, that made him presidential. So this from The Intercept. During his address to Congress, he paid tribute to Ryan Owens. That was the Navy SEAL that was killed in the January raid in Yemen that Trump, of course, ordered. As he did so, television cameras focused for almost 4 full minutes on Owens' grieving wife, Karen, as she wept and applauded while sitting next to and periodically being touched by Trump's daughter, Ivanka. The entire chamber stood together in sustained applause, with Trump interjecting scripted lyrical expression of support and gratitude for her husband's sacrifice. It was, as intended, an obviously powerful TV moment. Independent of the political intent behind it, any well-functioning human being would feel great empathy watching a grieving spouse mourning to struggle and struggling to cope emotionally with the recent sudden death of her partner. The majestic setting of the U.S. Congress, solemnly presided over by the U.S. president, vested the moment with political gravity. And this is where media commentators began gushing about how this is the moment he became presidential. This isn't something that Trump pioneered, by the way. It is completely standard for U.S. presidents. Obama often did this, including tales of sacrifice and death and suffering soldiers in his political speeches, including when he devoted 4 highly emotional minutes in 2014, State of the Address, to narrating the story of and paying emotional tribute to Sergeant Corey Remsburg, who was severely wounded by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. George W. Bush also hauled soldiers wounded in his wars in front of the cameras during his speeches, such as his 2007 State of the Union Address, where he paid tribute to Sergeant Tommy Riemann, who was wounded in Iraq. There are reasons presidents routinely use the suffering and deaths of U.S. soldiers and their families as political props. The way in which these emotions are exploited powerfully highlights important aspects of war propaganda, and specifically how the endless 15-year-old war on terror is being sustained. The raid in Yemen that cost Ryan Owens his life also killed 30 other people, including many civilians, at least 9 of whom were children. None of them were mentioned by Trump in his speech, let alone honored with applause and the presence of grieving relatives. That's because they were Yemenis, not Americans. Therefore, their deaths and lives must be ignored. The only exception was a fleeting media mention of the 8-year-old daughter of Anwar al-Awlaki, but only because she was a U.S. citizen and because of the irony that Obama killed her 16-year-old brother with a drone strike. This is standard fare in U.S. war propaganda. We fixate on the Americans killed, learning their names and life stories, apply to their spouses, parents, and so on and so forth, but steadfastly ignore the innocent people that the U.S. government is killing, whose numbers are always far greater. Yeah, 58,000 people died in Vietnam, but so did 2 million Vietnamese. We've had hundreds of thousands of people killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, but the only number you really hear about are the 4,000 U.S. soldiers. By dramatizing the deaths of Americans while disappearing the country's victims, this technique ensures that Americans perpetually regard themselves as victims of horrific, savage, tragic violence, but never the perpetrators of it. That, in turn, is what keeps Americans supporting endless war. These savages keep killing us, so we have no choice but to fight them. I was chilled, and chilled to the bone, by this show at that speech, because I know that Americans, especially, are suckers for this kind of thing, especially since we have been in a perpetual state of warfare. Trump said that when he comes in, he wants to make America great again. He wants to bring jobs back. He wants to build infrastructure. But he's doing none of those things right now. He's working towards none of those ends. And as a matter of fact, all of that money that he said he wanted to put into infrastructure, he wants to give it as tax credits and what he calls a public-private partnership to rebuild infrastructure. You don't need tax credits. Giving more money to the rich isn't what's going to do it. Actually spending the government's money is what's going to do it. But instead, he's talking about giving tax cuts to construction companies and just hoping that they do it. And then is really doing nothing to bring jobs home. And then he's cutting all of these programs all over the place that might actually bring jobs home, that might actually rebuild our infrastructure. But as far as the U.S. military goes, he's exploding that even further. I don't mind paying taxes. I consider it the price of living in a civilized society. I benefit as much as anybody does from the government and from infrastructure and all these other things. And growing up, my mother never worked. And so we lived on welfare. And so, yeah, I was raised with this free government money. I've become a productive member of society since then. And I like to think that I've paid it back at this point. But I don't mind paying taxes when it's for things like that. But what's happening with our tax dollars? And by the way, you're not going to get a tax break. Millionaires and billionaires, they're going to get tax breaks. You're going to continue to pay taxes and lots of taxes. And it's all going to go for war. And this particular president is just craven enough that he would do whatever it takes to start another war in order to ensure that he ends up with more power. And what history has shown us is that he definitely will end up with more power if he continues to not only engage in the current wars that we're in, but also to start new wars. The Muslim ban came out the day before the Yemen raid. And then the Yemen raid, of course, the Yemen raid happens the next day, and it goes off very terribly. One of the countries that was named, that people could not come from, in Trump's Muslim ban was Yemen. And then the next day he went into Yemen. Picture this. He bans people coming from Yemen into the United States. The next day decides to carry out a raid in Yemen. Do you think that the Yemen people are going to be receptive in that raid? Helpful in that raid? Perhaps do you think that the Yemen people are not going to tip off the people who are the potential targets of that raid? It doesn't make any sense. Yet, the raid was still carried out. And we lost a service person. Several other service people were hurt really badly, and a couple dozen civilians were killed. We didn't talk about that, though. We talked about the one that was killed and how brave he was. And then we paraded his wife in front of the cameras for four full minutes in what is some of the finest and yet most awful war propaganda that I have ever seen. So this is the point, and this is where we go from here. It's not enough, like I say every week, to talk about it. You got to be about it. So where do we come in? Right now, our politicians are still running scared from us. They don't want to see us. They don't want to hear from us. My representative quit taking phone calls a long time ago. And so I told my people to start faxing her. I said that she's going to get the faxes. Go on some of the free faxing sites. Well, a lot of representatives have now shut down their fax machines and even removed the fax lines from their websites, because they don't want to hear from you. They just want this guy to have an imperial presidency, and they don't care what you think. So here's what that means. This means that we need to keep up the pressure. If Trump wants a war, if he allows a terrorist attack to happen, and I believe that he would, there's not too much that we as the people can do about that. But as far as America's response to that particular terrorist attack goes, this is where you and I hold a lot of sway. Now, if Trump allows a terrorist attack to happen, conservatives are going to be the same generally as they always are on this subject. We got to do something. We got to answer them. We got to go out there, got to kill them. And we are going to have to be strong and say, no, more violence is not going to solve this problem. We need to find out what's really going on. We need to not send more men and women to their deaths. We need to not spend more money on war. We need to not get involved in more armed conflicts. This is where you, a progressive, and I'm assuming that you at the other end of this microphone are a progressive. This is where you are going to need to get at your representative and say no. We are not, you are not going to vote for us to go into another country. You're not going to vote for us to go into another war. You're not going to drag us into another armed conflict. No. And this is where you have to stand strong. And they're going to say, but we were attacked and our people and all the rest. And you get, no, 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 no. Because you see what happened in Iraq. You see what happened in Afghanistan. And however many soldiers are killed, you can guess at the low end, at least 10 times more civilians from those other countries are going to be killed. So if 4,000 Americans die in the war, you can imagine 400,000 civilians from that country died as well. And yeah, just because they're not Americans doesn't mean that their lives don't matter. Just because you don't know them, just because they're not white, and just because they're not wearing an American uniform does not mean that their lives do not matter, because their lives do as well. And we need to start fighting our way out of this perpetual state of warfare. We need an investigation into what happened in Russia. We need to understand that the Russian people are not our enemy, but Putin is most certainly not our friend. And we need to make sure that this irresponsible and illegitimate president does not get more power than he already has. And we need to continue to press against our senators and other representatives, whether they want to hear from us or not. They need to hear from us. If we go quiet on this, right, if we just turn our backs and if we get frustrated and we throw our hands up, they're going to do whatever the hell they want. But they're going to continue to do whatever the hell they want in your name. And by the way, with your money. And yeah, it's not you dying today. It's not your relative dying today, but it might be tomorrow. And I understand that's a selfish reason for getting involved, but you need to, I see other people as I see myself. I try to always put myself in other folks' shoes. And if it's not happening to me, but it's happening to my countrymen, well, by proxy, it's happening to me. And if it's not directly happening to me, it will be soon. I try to see myself as my countrymen, as my brothers and sisters. For the rest of you out there, continue to work, continue to resist, continue to get in contact with your legislator, and I will continue to do the same. The media, he's lying about the media. Both Putin and Trump are both lying about the media. It isn't that the media is lying. It isn't that the media is dishonest. It's that the media is shining a light on the horrible things that this president is doing. And democracy dies in darkness. So we can't lose that light. So continue to support your local press. Continue to support the New York Times. Continue to support the Washington Post. Continue to support The Hill. Continue to support Politico. And every time he mentions a specific outlet and he calls them fake news, you need to start reading as much of what that outlet is putting out as possible. These are seemingly dark days, but these are also days that are providing us with an opportunity. Go forth. Be strong. We can still get this done. We've got an election next year. It may not seem like it, but the time to reconcile this is just right around the corner. Whew! I need a glass of water. Ladies and gentlemen, Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out there. You can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We're on the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a special thanks to you for listening. This is Melvin, signing off. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.